I had a chance to work with some really legendary people. Nonetheless, it didn't fulfill me. And it wasn't until much later that I found that I was really good at defending other kid actors and helping them get through the rough patches because I had gone through it.
Thank you for listening to Vanguard of Hollywood. I'm Shannon Allen. My guest today is none other than Paul Peterson. In addition to his time as one of Walt Disney's original Mouseketeers, Paul has worked with such Hollywood legends as Cary Grant, Sophia Loren, Barbara Stanwyck, Fred McMurray, Sally Field, and Harrison Ford. But Paul is probably best remembered as Donna Reed's son, the lovable Jeff Stone, in the popular and long-running Donna Reed Show. Paul has also enjoyed a successful career as a recording artist with Motown and sold over 1 million singles and records for Columbia Pictures music label Colpix. He's also a prolific writer with 20 books to his name. But the greatest of Paul's accomplishments is his work for A Minor Consideration, a nonprofit organization founded by Paul and his wife, Rana, to provide guidance and support for young performers. Paul, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Shannon. It's a pleasure. I'm all set.
Awesome. Well, let's get right to it. How did you get started in show business?
Well, I try to tell people the truth. My mom was bigger than me, and I and my older sister, Pam, were subjected to endless dance lessons, singing lessons, piano lessons. It was endless. The problem was we were both pretty good, up to and including appearances at the Hollywood Bowl in 1953 and 54. And one day, my dance teacher, Sally Sargent, said to my mom, "I want you guys to go to an interview tomorrow at Disney." And we showed up. There were about 3,000 young boys and 3,000 young women, all of them talented, competing for a role on The Mouseketeers. And wouldn't you know it, at the end of the day, I got hired. I was 9 years old, didn't have a work permit, didn't have a Social Security card, none of that. I wasn't a member of the unions. But we took care of all of that practical stuff. And then I went to work, 9 years old. Now, the good part about this, Shannon, is that it took 7 weeks before they fired me. And I mean outright fired me, because I wasn't happy with the work situation. And I was, the joke goes, performing without a net.
Can I ask you why you got fired from the Mickey Mouse Club?
I was incorrigible. My third grade teacher, Miss Carnes, said, "Paul is a fine student, but his behavior is abominable."
Oh, no.
No, the last day of work, people, they kept calling me Mouse. I was so small. I didn't look at all to be 9 years old. I was smaller than Cubby. And Cubby and Karen were the youngest.
Right.
And one day, the casting guy, his name was Lee
Travers.
That's the guy, came up behind me, at me on the shoulder and said, "Hey, Mouse, how you doing?" I hate nicknames. I particularly hated Mouse. I turned around and punched him in the stomach and said, "Don't call me that, Fatso."
Oh, my gosh.
Well, standing behind Fatso was Walt Disney.
Oh, my gosh.
And at 4 o'clock that afternoon, I was let go.
Wow.
Well, yeah, wow.
Did you ever see Walt again?
Oh, sure. Interestingly, when the Donna Reed Show finished, my first acting job as a young adult was for Walt Disney with his last movie, Happiest Millionaire. And I, you know, I apologized to him for being such a handful. And he said, "You're just a kid. It's okay."
Yeah.
We all kind of laughed about it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was.
So most of your Mouseketeer colleagues, as your book, Walt, Mickey, and Me, underscores, and it's a great book. I read it, such a page turner. But I noticed that they all had trouble finding work after the Mouseketeers, and you didn't. And eventually you end up in Houseboat, major Hollywood film.
Yes, it was. And the co-stars were, you know, Harry Gardino, Martha Heyer. But the kids who played my brother and sister, Mimi Gibson and Charlie Herbert, they were accomplished young performers even then. And now the year is 1957. I turned 12 years old on the movie. But it was a wonderful experience. My goodness, working with Cary Grant and the young and incredibly alluring Sophia Loren.
Yes.
Who was like everybody's favorite Italian big sister. She was great. And I had a great time.
Do you have any specific memories of working with Cary Grant?
Oh, tons. You know, he was a complete professional. And he treated me as a professional performer. He wanted me to understand the purpose of every scene I was in with him. He wanted me to be respectful. I called him Mr. G then. I called him Mr. G till he died. Wow. We became, as much as was able at that, given the disparity in our ages and his status, we became friends. I would often see him out to dinner. He came to one of my weddings. He brought Diane Cannon was his.
Oh, no way.
Yes, he did. And he was a wonderful man. And I had the chance to ask him, you know, because he was so accomplished. I liked him better as a dramatic actor, but as the straight man, how he was able to be Cary Grant. And he said, I never forgot that my name is Archie Leach. And there you go. He had his feet on the ground.
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear. Well, and how about Sophia Loren? Do you have any favorite memories of working with Sophia?
Well, I have a picture of myself at age 12 asleep on her lap.
Oh, my gosh.
And as I say to my chums, I knew where I was.
Yeah.
You know, she was a statuesque, full-figured woman who was just incredibly sensual. But she called me Paulito, and she would, you know, kind of touch my face, and what a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
You know, and she was new to the industry, at least at that level, but she was romantically linked to Cary Grant. Meanwhile, she was about to marry Carlo Ponti.
Right.
So there were a lot of stuff. A lot of stuff was going on.
Right. According to Mimi Gibson, despite all of the personal life situation between Cary Grant and Sophia Loren, Mimi said that they were complete professionals.
Absolutely true. And it was a good lesson. Cary Grant, we were in the middle. I tell this story because I want people to understand. I think you may have heard me talk about this, Shannon. In the middle of a very difficult shot with Harry Gardino and a big Atlas crane and Klieg lights and arc lights and a traveling camera. A guy up in the rafters in the middle of the take could be heard choking. He was trying not to cough. And Cary Grant, without breaking character, suddenly looked out at the crew and said, let's let the poor bugger cough. And just stopped everything.
Wow, yeah.
And after, you know, a couple of minutes, then everybody got right back into it. He was a man of immense stature. I had a chance to work with some really legendary people, working with Henry Fonda, with Barbara Stanwyck. When I worked with Harrison Ford, I had no idea that he would be Harrison Ford.
Yeah. I want to ask you specifically about that in a little bit. First, not long after Houseboat, you end up on the Donna Reed Show. And I mean, talk about a dream job. How did you land that?
Well, I went up for it in a competitive audition. thank goodness I was matched with Shelley Fabre to play my older sister, to be Mary Stone. And we had worked together the year before in a pilot with Sherry Lewis. So we knew each other, and we had that big sister, insufferable little brother act down. Cary Grant told Donna that he had a lot of confidence in my ability. And of course, Shelley, with her lineage with Nanette Fabre, was a natural choice, a beautiful girl on the cusp of becoming a gorgeous ingenue. And when that job happened, I try to remind everybody, it was just one job. Nobody could look into the future and say, the show is going to be an enormous success. It's going to last 8 years. That's not the way you thought. You had a job.
Yeah.
We did the pilot, waited anxiously, like everybody in the cast and crew, for the debut, which was not very auspicious, I'll tell you, because they put us on Tuesday night at 10 o'clock.
Oh, my gosh.
10 o'clock. But not for a family show. But by the grace of God and the wife of the chairman of the board of Campbell Soup, she insisted that they move us to a family-friendly hour. And ABC, under the pressure of the advertiser, moved us over to Thursday night at 8 o'clock, and there we stayed for 8 years.
You found your audience, and eight years to show just what a wonderful show it was. How did being, I mean, 8 years on a TV show, how did that affect your personal life?
It changed everything, because you become known. You become, quote unquote, a celebrity. And in that day, in 1958, there were only three networks. ABC was the smallest of all. But we were on in people's living room every Thursday night. And Tony Dow said it great. Tony Dow, you remember him from Leave It to Beaver? When he got the job to play Wally, he said, oof, there went my life. Because all the options that you may have had open, all of the promise that you had, both as a person and in terms of making your way in the culture, shrank. They didn't expand. They shrank. The possibilities came down to, you better be a damn good performer and stick with it. Well, my grandfather, Grandpa Burr, watched, frankly, with growing worry as I became less attached to that public person my character was. And he said to me, Paul, you got to find a job that you love, and then you won't go to work a day in your life. So I had a standoffish nature towards playing the character. But mind you now, I'm working with Donna Reed, an Academy Award-winning actress from Iowa, our ancestral home. Arl Betts, a Carnegie Award-winning actor and a fine one. Shelley Fabre. It was a wonderful experience on a professional level.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it didn't fulfill me.
So with the Donna Reed show, Shelley Fabre is your sister. You guys right. have this wonderful relationship, both on screen and off screen.
Yes.
Now, I've read that Shelley was also your introduction to Elvis Presley.
That's correct. Yes. You know, Shelley, she's had a remarkable career. She got to do three movies with Elvis. She never tells story about him. To this day, she won't tell Elvis stories. But she wasn't happy with me because I didn't properly credit Elvis with the level of his talent. And just, I didn't accord to him the same respect I had for Cary Grant. And Shelley demanded that I come to the studio one day when he was scheduled to sing. And I had met him before. We ran in the same clubs. We had our hair cut at the same place at J. Sebring's. We had met. Anyway, I get on the set and Shelley is standing next to me when they started the click track for him to sing. And all of a sudden, there was Elvis. And when he finished the song and they said, cut, Shelley like punched me in the shoulder and says, what do you got to say now? Because when he performed, that was Elvis. Goodness, Elvis. It was a thrill.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's really very special. And typical older sister, Shelley took a great delight in making me crow.
Right. Well, and I have to tell you, Paul, I'm in the midst. I've been researching Elvis's life for a few years now for a podcast series that I'll be doing on him soon. And I was doing an image search on Bing, and I can't remember what the exact search was, but I was trying to find pictures of Elvis from a certain point in his career. And this picture comes up, and I do a double take at it. And I say, you know, I've never seen that picture of Elvis before. I look closer and I realize it's not a picture of Elvis. It's a picture of you. Bing had confused a picture of you for a picture of Elvis. You two really looked like each other. It's uncanny.
In real life, this is after hours at nightclubs and stuff, Elvis called me little brother.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
He did so because we did look alike. Jay Sebring cut our hair. We would meet at the shop. It was a wonderful comparison in my heart. As much as I wanted to be seen as that kind of, you know, matinee idol, singer, pop, and all the rest, the truth was, I didn't have that sensuous quality that he had, nor did I have a desire, that burning desire to please everybody. I just didn't. That's why, frankly, my singing career was so abruptly ended, at least in my mind, because I didn't like it. And the idea that I would live 30, 40, 50 years singing the same damn song over and over, no thanks.
Yeah, I could see that getting old. But I got to say, you signed with Motown.
Yes, because I could sing. You know, I keep trying to explain to people, it wasn't an accident that I got work or that I had a hit record, not as big as Shelley Fabre with Johnny Angel, but it wasn't an accident. I didn't mind getting in front of people and singing. I was not afraid to even dance, going on Shindig and stuff like that. But it wasn't fulfilling. And it wasn't until, frankly, much later when we founded A Minor Consideration on the heels of some tragedy that I found my calling. Something that on a day-to-day basis gives me such satisfaction to help other people.
I want to say too, the entertainment being produced today, to be frank, is not worth watching.
No, it's tawdry.
Yeah. You look back on a show like the Donna Reed Show, I think the messages in that show are more needed than ever today. And I have this quote that you said in 2008. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read it to you because I'd like to know your thoughts today on this. You said the Donna Reed Show depicts a better time and place. It has a sort of level of intelligence and professionalism that is sadly lacking in current entertainment products. The messages it sent out were positive and uplifting. It provided 22 and a half minutes of moral instruction and advice on how to deal with the little dilemmas in life. That's what the show is really about, the importance of family. That's where life lessons are transmitted generation to generation. There's a certain way these are transmitted with love and affection, unquote. I love that. I love that quote so much. It touches my heart. And I wanted to ask you, do you think that that emphasis on family and traditional values was the secret to the show's success?
Well, yes, it was. We genuinely liked each other. And I tell people stories about what it's like to work with an Academy Award-winning actress like Donna Reed, who beyond the stature, and mind you, she was second only to Lucille Ball as a success story in Hollywood, but I called her mom. She was an Iowa farm girl at heart, immensely talented, yes, but she was connected to people. She liked them. She knew how to listen. She had four children at home. And she had to walk a tightrope between being a mom with four kids and being a television mom. And those lessons of the Donna Reed show, up to bottom, I'm including not just Donna Reed and Carl Betts as the stars, but the crew. Gerd Anderson, our cinematographer. George Hager, our grip. Maxie, the prop man. They were my family. And they were competent professionals. And Columbia Pictures was a lot of fun. It's not a huge MGM. It wasn't like Fox. It was Harry Cohn's baby.
Yeah.
And I loved going there. I really did.
It's so nice to hear behind the scenes of such a wonderful show was just as wonderful.
Well, it was. And I have to tell you, Shannon, you'll love this. In public, I always called Donna Reed Miss Reed, always. And we went to lunch after the show was off the air. Every month, we would get together at the Bistro in Beverly Hills, Carl and Shelley and Donna and me, and we'd have four-hour lunches. And one day, I guess I was almost 26, so this is 5 years after the show stopped production, she leaned across the table and said, "Paul, I think it's time you started calling me Donna." That's how long it took. And it wasn't because I was intimidated or I wasn't reverential. It was, that's who she was. She was Miss Reed, my boss.
And after the Donna Reed show, you had some really great performances in various television shows and films. And there's one show I wanted to ask you about in particular, The Big Valley. I watched your episode of The Big Valley with Barbara Stanwyck. I mean, your performance is so amazing. You're so good. You and Barbara are the heroes of that episode.
Yeah.
What was it like filming with Barbara?
It was wonderful. First of all, she was just a little slip of a woman and not an ingenue. She was an experienced and quite crafty actress. She really was. And she liked working with me, too, because when I had jobs like that, I stepped up my game.
You did.
Not all kid actors. Well, Tony Dow taught me this, my life friend, how I miss him. Because I would complain to him, why aren't more famous kid stars getting work in Hollywood? And Tony said to me, "Paul, not all kid actors are quality performers." And sadly, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, you certainly were. And we talked a little bit about this earlier. Harrison Ford, you made two films with Harrison Ford. One of them, Journey to Shiloh. I loved it. It was so good. What a fantastic cast. So many of these just young, up-and-coming actors. And Harrison Ford in the film, I don't think I would have really Given his performance a second glance, had I not known what he went on to become, you are the standout performance in that film. You're great. Did you at the time see anything in Harrison Ford?
At the time, what I saw and liked was a competent, quiet performer.
Wow.
We were all under contract to Universal. They threw us in that picture. But Jimmy Kahn was the head of our posse. And he had us all together from the beginning. And we all knew we were being stuck in this picture for contract reasons. And he said, let's make this thing better than it is. And I think when you watch the film, you can see we did. Don Stroud and Michael Sarrazin, wonderful actors. Michael Fox, Harrison. It was lots of fun.
Well, it's a great film, and I was so happy to find it and see you. And again, the surprise of a very young Harrison Ford who hadn't yet found his eventual big roles.
Well, exactly. When I first saw him in Star Wars, I remember in the theater going, I worked with that guy. He was wonderful, has been consistently solid performances.
Yeah. Wow. So, Paul, your performance in Journey to Shiloh is wonderful. In all of your post-Donna Reed work, you've proved yourself in television, music, films. You have the leading man looks, charisma, talent. And for some reason, your career just didn't take off the way I thought it should. And it's completely inexplicable.
No, it's not inexplicable. It's what happens. There is nothing more tiresome than a bubblegum star getting older. Hollywood routinely turns its back on its young performers. It does it all the time and has since Jackie Coogan. That's why Mickey Rooney came to my house unannounced and said, Paul, you got to get out of town. Go get your education because they won't let you work for 25 years. And I said to him, Mick, why are you telling me this? Now, mind you, this is in my own living room. Why are you telling me this? Because, he said, it happened to me. Because he was in 1941, the biggest star in the world. Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, oh my word. And then they wouldn't let him work because they were done with him. And I remind people when he finally eventually started to work again and won the Emmy for Bill and was holding the Emmy in his hand in front of a big audience. And he said to them, when I was 19 and 20, I was the biggest star in the world. And when I was 40, you wouldn't give me a job. You know, the talent, Shannon, doesn't evaporate. If you're skilled at something, it's with you always.
So Mickey Rooney was really the inspiration, the pivotal advice that got you out of Hollywood and on a new path. And you end up going to school, you get your degree in literature, and this is before a minor consideration, you become an author. And you've written 20 books.
I know, isn't that something?
It's amazing.
I'm amazed myself.
when did you know? I mean, I noticed that you actually wrote a few episodes of the Donna Reed Show as well. So did you know for a while that you wanted to be a writer before it took off?
Well, not really. I mean, I was encouraged always. Carl Betts especially wanted me to write. Donna was very supportive, and they bought my first script, Never Look a Gift House in the Mouth. In fact, I got a residual check from the Writers Guild.
Oh, awesome.
It was funny, $3.09. that has always been in my back pocket. I know one interview was for Marcus Welby, and I didn't get the job, and I thought I should. I really did think I nailed the audition. So I went home, and with my friend Artie Rubenstein, I wrote a script for Marcus Welby, one in which the lead boy character, the baseball player, dies, malignant melanoma. They bought it. They bought my script. And Nina Lemley, from the famous Lemley family, said, well, I assume now you want to play the part. And I could, in all honesty, look her right in the eye and say, no, I want to see another actor play the part. And I meant it.
Wow.
Because the satisfaction was having created it.
Yeah.
And when it came time to write, my first book was about one of my loves of my life had been automobiles. And I wrote a book called High Performance Driving under contract to Simon & Schuster Trident. And it was very well received. And it led to a lifestyle that I cherished. People didn't recognize me on the street. I lived in Westport, Connecticut, and Wallingford at first. And I was kind of known as the guy who you could find him at the local library, researching arcane things like icebergs and Mayan culture.
Wow.
That was me, and I loved it. Got married, started a family back there in Connecticut. They were very nourishing. And I learned so many things without the celebrity. Things that New Englanders understand. Use it up, wear it out. Make it do or do without. It was true. If you're going to build a home, build a good one. You know, that's amazing. I enjoyed my time in Connecticut, but circumstances brought me back to Southern California.
And actually, this is a great segue into something that I wanted to touch on before a minor consideration. I noticed that the paternal instinct has been present in you from a very early age. Just as I've been doing the research here, you were the legal guardian for your sister Patty on the Donna Reed Show when she came on for the last three seasons. You promoted WAIF, Jane Russell's Intercountry Adoption Agency, on American Bandstand in 1964. And in another mid-60s interview, you stated that your dream was to have nine kids and that, and I'm quoting here, if I were to die tomorrow, there's only one thing I'd miss, and that's not having a family, unquote. You're a young man in your late teens when you're saying and doing these things. So clearly this paternal instinct has been a thread throughout your life. Did you ever think that you'd end up being this great advocate for kids?
Well, in truth, yes, I did.
Wow.
My nickname in grade school now, with the career starting in Hollywood, was Uncle Paul. That's what even my chums called me, Uncle Paul. A first girlfriend saying why she liked me as opposed to being gaga over Elvis, thought and said to me, well, you have kind eyes.
Oh.
And at the time, I resented it. I wanted to be, you know,
right,
electric. But in the end, yeah, I'll take kindness. And my family, and mind you, this is with three children, three beautiful children, grown now. My family is way larger than four kids. There are, in any given year, about 600,000 professional young performers under the age of 17. And the people at Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA, where I served on the board for 25 years, will tell you they all belong to me. Everyone.
What a compliment. So a minor consideration is a nonprofit organization, and you are the greatest advocate for working kids. You provide emotional support, education, you draft legislation, and you work to get it passed. What inspired you to begin this work?
Given the era, and we're talking 1990, I got tired of going to funerals because many of my contemporaries were in desperate trouble. Some had killed themselves, like Rusty Hamer from Danny Thomas's show, who was alone but for his brother, in DeRidder, Louisiana. And when his suicide was announced, I sat up in bed and said to my wife, that's never going to happen again. If another kid actor, former kid star, is in distress, I'm going to show up. And I'm knocking on wood as I say this. That's what we do. We show up. Now, we're not always welcome. I grant you that. River Phoenix didn't want to talk to us at all. And when we left the apartment complex, I said to my friend, he'll be dead soon. And it wasn't 2 years later that he was dead outside of the Viper nightclub with his own brother not telling the truth to the paramedics about the drugs that River had ingested. Just, oh, that still rankles me to this day. When Charlie Herbert, who played the little boy in Houseboat, he had a wonderful career. When Charlie got into trouble and couldn't quit drinking, despite the support even of his employers there at the Palace Station, they were trying to help. But I called Mimi Gibson and said, Mimi, Charlie's in trouble in Las Vegas. Let's go get him. And we did. We took our spouses and we drove to Vegas and we corralled them. Look, buddy, you got to change. We love you. We will not abandon you. This isn't about employment. Got no job to offer you, but we love you. And he did straighten up. And though he died in a halfway house, he was happier and more content than he had been for the past 30 years.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So,
yeah, it is amazing. The turnarounds we have witnessed, oh my goodness. The parents who have come to us when the ball game is all over and their kid is in trouble, they come to us and say, why didn't we listen to you? Well, I can't make you drink the water, but you can at least listen to the people who have been there.
Yeah. In Walt, Mickey, and Me, You Call Fame, this really struck me. You call it the hardest narcotic known to man.
Oh, I think so, yes.
And these kid actors are getting a taste of that fame at a very young age. How does that early fame contribute to their difficulty transitioning to adulthood and life away from the camera?
Well, it alienates you from social interactions. All of a sudden, you are the beast being observed rather than being the observer, where you can learn so much. You know, my grandfather would say, Paul, you have two ears and one tongue, so you better listen twice as much as you talk. And it's the truth. Young performers live in a bubble. And someone dresses them, someone does their hair, someone puts on makeup, they give them witty dialogue to say. And you can't help but think, well, this is all normal. It's not normal. Getting a black eye defending your sister's honor is normal. You know, falling off your bike is normal. Not being able to afford to go to the movies is normal. I didn't live that life. And don't get me wrong, it was a lot of fun being rich and famous, but it wasn't fun losing all that, losing what I thought was important. But I think I landed in a pretty good place.
Oh, yeah. Well, and taking your experience and now helping others. And you've been successful at drafting and passing legislation to protect kids.
Shan, that's what I'm really good at. Honest to goodness, I was shocked myself. They told us we would never be able to pass legislation in California. They were too dependent on the industry. Well, we passed the preemie bill in 90 days, had 100% yay votes. The governor promptly signed. It's called the preemie bill. What did that do? It prevents Hollywood from hiring premature infants who are so vulnerable, dangerously vulnerable, their eyesight, their lungs.
Why would they even want to be hiring? What's the motivation behind hiring a premature baby?
A premature baby is very small and looks like a newborn.
Okay, Yeah.
And that's their motivation. It's the part.
Yeah.
We
They're not
actually
thinking
had
about the child's health and
not at all. They wouldn't put their own kids in that circumstance. But if it comes time to hire an actor, oh, shoot, anyone will do. And they do it.
Wow.
We had a gal, Dee Dee, a nurse, who was confronted on a set by a producer and writer and adult co-stars who were set to anesthetize a newborn.
Oh my gosh.
So the baby would appear dead. Can you
Oh my
imagine?
gosh.
How could you be corrupt in your soul not to understand that you are responsible for that child?
Yeah.
Not in the abstract, but on a daily basis, especially if you're working with them. Well, we fix that. Oh, listen to me. I get on my soapbox all the time.
No,
I'm
no.
Sorry.
Can I give you my closing statement?
Yes, please. I'm delighted to hear.
You start chapter 15 of Walt, Mickey, and Me with one of my favorite quotes from George Bernard Shaw. And I want to share that quote now because your work with the minor consideration is the embodiment of Shaw's words. He says, quote, "This is the true joy in life, to be used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one. The being thoroughly worn out before you are thrown on the scrap heap. The being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy," unquote. Paul, you've dedicated your life to a mighty purpose. You are a force of nature for working kids, past, present, and future. Has your work with minor consideration brought you this true joy in life that Shaw speaks of?
Yes, it has. Boy, remind me. Well, George Bernard Shaw is a pretty smart old boy.
Yes.
It makes my eyes hot. It really does. Thank you so much for visiting with me today.
Thank you, Paul. I enjoyed it so much.
Me too.
Thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you, Shannon. You take care.
Thank you. You as well.